now have time for questions from the audience, and we have two microphones. So please take your place by the microphones and present any comments, observations, or questions you might have for our speakers.
Yes, I'm Walton Padelford from Union University. Mr. Granado, I have read recently, or I was teaching in an economic development class about some measure of poverty, and I can't remember the name, maybe the Thornbeck Index or something. It calculates percentages of populations in poverty in a certain mathematical way that emphasizes that number. But the point was that this number or this index was written into the Mexican Constitution. This is what the text said. That was very surprising to me, if that's true, that something that kind of detailed would be have arisen to the constitutional level. So I guess maybe if you could comment on that.
I just want to remind everyone that the Mexican Constitution of 1917 is the twin sister of the Soviet Constitution of 1918. I won't say anything more.
I was interested in the comment about the lack of private law in Latin America. I wondered if you could elaborate a little bit on that. How are some of the, what are some of the examples of how, of the absence of necessary private law?
Yes, okay. What we need to do in the 21st century in Latin America is to deconstitutionalize the legal system. If you look at, let's look at U.S. law and let's look at German civil law. Both of our legal systems respect contractual freedom, because in Latin America we have French civil law, but it hasn't developed. So our business law is very different from the U.S. or from German law. Why? Well, an economy is not just a question of contractual freedom. Private law has, Hernando de Soto's fetishism with property rights is only part of the answer. We need contracts, but contracts are necessarily incomplete. We know that in law and economics. It's costly to write a complete contract. Too costly. Plus, we really don't know the future, so what do we do? Private law has a system. In the US, you have a system of quasi-contracts. You call them fiduciary rights. And they really are very important for the design of business law in US law. In German civil law, the concept of good faith, taken from Roman law, because our civil law contracts descend from the consensual Roman contracts. We have lost the flexibility of Roman contracting through stipulation, for example. All of our contracts are typical Roman contracts. So what Germans have done to sort of mimic what happens in the US legal system in developing their commercial law is they have overextended this concept of good faith. We haven't. We have not developed our private law. Why? Because everything has come down to social revolutions and social rights and constitutionalism. And so in the 20th century, we're still using European, in our law schools in Latin America, we're still using books that were written in Europe at the beginning of the 20th century. We have no idea about the development of European civil law in the 20th century in Germany and in France. We have, even though we have such a homogeneous legal system throughout all of Latin America, it should be very easy to improve private law, but we just don't do it. We lack a scholarly community, we lack good libraries, we lack standing faculty, we lack tenure, which allows professors not to be afraid to hire people who are smarter than they are to sit on faculties with them. There are just so many problems. And another problem we have are Latin American studies in the US, people who dedicate themselves to studying us and who have no clue of what's really going on in Latin America. What we need are local scholars that have a stake in Latin America, like I do. I've lost my home, my country, everything. I'm someone without a country right now. I feel very honored that the president of the Bolivian Senate is going to be speaking after I speak. The situation in my country is... However, what we need in the future is to focus on private law. I think economic integration is a great opportunity. Germany learned its lesson. Germany has invested in the rest of Europe. They took over Europe without having to go to war. The U.S. has to start investing in Latin America. If you're going to dedicate yourselves to nation building and building democracy, start in Latin America rather than other places that are farther away. I moved to Mexico in January, but I had a meeting with Vicente Fox's finance minister at the end of November, just before he left office, and I visited him, and I was in Mexico City, and I saw the street marches, and I saw what almost happened in Mexico with López Obrador. My country is on its way to becoming a terrorist state. Imagine if that happened to Mexico for the United States. We are really not that different. Yes, we're Catholics. You are evangelicals. Now, evangelical Christianity has taken root in Latin America as well. We're really quite close. We share such similar experiences, some of the same problems. The U.S. is, if you don't come and help us in Latin America, we're all going to end up living in the U.S. Thank you.
Professor Garalia.
You want to speak?
Could I ask a question to my colleague here? Are you being too optimistic about about what we have here as far as the development of a legal system in the United States is going and has been going for decades now? I mean, some might say that it's not going very well either, the way the law is developing it.
American universities have some serious problems. But American legal education is very strong. Because in Latin America, we are two revolutions behind the US in legal education. Dean Christopher Columbus Langdell's revolution at the end of the 19th century, which meant that the US had a supply of highly well-trained legal technocrats who were able to occupy spaces in business and government starting at the end of the 19th century, one of the factors in the ascendancy of the US. And then let us not forget Dean Henry Manny's revolution in the second half of the 20th century in American legal education. You see, even though, yes, some of the things that legal academics do are bizarre. Some of the things that they write are ridiculous. However, there's a counterweight. It's called law and economics. At least it balances things out. People have, intelligent thinking people have, can have a perspective. Can you imagine a place where you don't have anything other than either very dogmatic, old legal thinking, or alternatively Marxist orthodoxy? I'm not pessimistic about the US. You have so much that is right. You've had it for such a long time. You're certainly not going to lose it. In Latin America, we lost it at the end of the 19th century. I'm sorry, I'm not really answering your question directly. Yes, I know that there's a bit of a crisis here in the US. But this crisis is not a problem with your markets. It is a problem with what, some of the things that the government has done. And it'll take a little time for people to figure out what exactly has happened. But the problem probably was government policy, not markets.
Professor Garalia.
I had a comment for each of our speakers. For Dario, I wondered just how civilized the Incas were, that they're imposing this civilization on the primitives. What had they achieved agriculturally, mechanically, in terms of government organization? How strong a civilization was that, and what could they, in fact, contribute. As you say, some groups didn't know how to make cotton and wool, and that could have been an advantage. I mean, today, the forest Indians in Brazil are using a lot of Western products, machinery, clothing, and so on. One could say the intrusions, whether or not it's a conquest, has in some extent been beneficial for them. The other speaker, you've just been touching on this to some extent, one of the fascinating things here, reading the papers, is revolution or a civil war inevitable in Bolivia? I mean, you say you're in exile. Exactly why? They're after you there. Is a civil war inevitable? Is there anything to be said for the kind of indigenous improvement of the indigenous population and the land reform that Morales says he's for? Thank you.
No doubt. See, the Incas were very, they were like the Romans. They were great organizers. So they took the best of what they found and they institutionalized it and universalized it and made you do it, whether you want it or not. And indeed, they, for one thing, they unified the entire area. So trade was increased among the different nations. There was now one single empire. There were all sorts of material advantages to the Inca conquest. So there is a lot of truth in what Garcilaso is saying. The Inca did benefit a lot of those Indians, frequently by transferring technology that they found in one area already to other areas. They were not great innovators. They used a lot of the pre-Inca cultures who had actually greater technological achievements than the Inca had. But we didn't know that until relatively recently because the Inca were so good at obliterating any traces of the previous cultures that we normally associate the great achievements of Inca culture with the Inca. But that is not true in many cases. Those achievements come from pre-Inca cultures that they conquered. It's a little bit like what happened with Roman Greece. So there were great benefits, but go ask a Chachapoya or the Chancas if they were willing to take those benefits. Obviously not. That's why they fought until the end, and they were totally destroyed. There are barely any traces of those cultures as a result. So you see the perennial quality of this issue.
Yes, 51% of Bolivians would identify themselves as Indians, but I wouldn't call them peasants necessarily. But that means that 49% of Bolivians are not Indians. Bolivia is a very heterogeneous country. Because of the Andes Mountains, all of our regions are very separated. We have different cultures. When I married my wife, who's from the east, I'm from the west, I'm from the mountains, she's from the Amazon, it was like marrying someone from another country. The problem with Evo Morales, of course, is not democracy. He's not a Democrat. That's the problem. And the problem in Bolivia, two things came together. One, U.S. drug policy in Bolivia. The United States Army entered my country and started burning down coca fields as part of the U.S. war on drugs. Any civilized country defends its agricultural sector. Farmers are politically always very powerful. So, of course, these coca growers organize themselves. Evo Morales is a coca union leader. And so that's one side of the equation. And the other thing is we have been invaded by Venezuela. The overthrow of Gonzalo Sanchez de Lozada was financed directly by Mr. Chavez. You do not mobilize a million people for 3 years without a lot of resources. We didn't know at the time, but it's very clear now. So Mr. Chavez is very, very dangerous for the region. Yes, my country is very poor. However, the way to combat poverty is not through social rights. and entitlements, the right to the way to combat poverty is not through violence. Yes, we may end up in a civil war, and that is going to produce even more poverty. Mr. Chavez was willing to go to war with Colombia. Of course, the Colombians thought it kind of funny because Mr. Chavez really did not have the armament to face off the well-organized and well-equipped Colombian army. But can you imagine a war? We're in the 21st century in Latin America. Mr. Chavez is absolutely insane. And I don't really care if he's a descendant of Montezuma. I have some Indian blood as well, even though I probably don't look very Indian. We all are a mixture of everything in America, Anglo-America and Latin America.
Thank you. Bill Campbell?
Yeah, Bill Campbell from the Philadelphia Society. I wanted to tie just some of the things you were just talking about with both of your talks, and that is to ask about the question of the importance of indigenismo as opposed to indigenous cultures, which are very diverse and varied and all that, but indigenismo as sort of a counterpart to multiculturalism in the United States, mainly a battle axe to attack Western civilization. And also in this, I guess I'd like to attack the sun. You mentioned that, I never heard this before, that Bolivar sort of thought of himself as the sun around which everything revolved, and it seemed like in Peru you had the same, they were descended from the sun, and I think of Tomaso Campanella and the city of the sun and the utopian mentality that inspired I think a lot of things that occurred in Latin America, but I'm sort of curious about the balance between the indigenous sort of movements to create the noble savage myth, if you wish to go back to that, as a way to beat up on Western civilization, versus perhaps the Enlightenment, enlightened despots and things like this, the Sun King, Louis XIV, and if you could sort that out for me, I'd appreciate it.
You have touched on a lot of stuff there. let me say something about the noble savage. The noble savage myth is part of the so-called myth of the Golden Age, which you mentioned as well. And that is part probably of every civilization, this idea that in the past there has existed a time when everything was peaceful, and human beings were in perfect harmony with Mother Earth, and so on and so forth, and that those inhabitants lived in a sort of golden savagery state. They were nice to each other. There was not, this is yours and this is mine. We shared everything. So we do find that sort of thing in every culture, and in the European Renaissance, 16th century, late 15th, there was a revival of this interest in the myth of the Golden Age, and it was reinforced by the discovery of the New World. Why? Because some of those European intellectuals who wrote about the New World, most of them had not been here, they thought that in this new world, they had found indeed a noble savage. This was partly the result of the early letters of Columbus, in which when he's trying to sell the colonization of the Americas to the Catholic monarchs, and he doesn't have much gold to offer, because in the Antilles there was not a lot of it, so he tries to beautify as much as possible the situation there, and he insists, you know, the Indians there are so mansos, and they're so buenitos, you know. So there are these noble savages, redivivos, you know, that we have found in the New World. So that was one aspect of the colonization that sometimes is not well known, that many Europeans, including many Spaniards, did think that these natives were just wonderful. And by the way, Las Casas participates of that idea. For Las Casas, all the Indians are wonderful. There are no bad Indians. They are noble savages. Of course, there is the other side of the coin, which sees these inhabitants of the New World as barbarians and savages. And if you cannot modify their religion and their ways, kill them. And many Spaniards thought that way. Some thought in between. It was like, especially Bernal Diaz, you know, in history. Bernal is I love Bernal, the way he looks at the situation. They are very down to earth. No hatred, no idealization either. But in Latin America today, for example, in Peru, there is still this idealization of the Inca past. And it is part of the myth of the country, just like we used to have the myth of the West. I don't think we have it anymore. It's been dashed to pieces. But in Peru, we still have the myth of the wonderful Inca past. So you don't hear this kind of commentary that I have just made. No. All you hear is about how wonderful and peaceful the empire of the Incas was. And of course, the empire of the Incas was in many ways a socialist society. So you see the problem we have there in Peru. We are idealizing an empire which was basically a socialist system where people really had to do things or you lost your head. I mean, you were killed. You didn't do what the Inca told you to do. So that is part of the tradition of Peru. Imagine. One of the previous presidents, I remember reading in the papers, in his inauguration, was brandishing the Inca axe and saying the name of the Inca axe, which ominously means cutter of heads. So he was brandishing that Inca symbol. You know, it's a great thing, and that's what the axe means. It's the name of the axe in Quechua is the cutter of heads. I mean, from a certain point of view, this indigenista tradition is a serious obstacle.
Hi, I'm Joe Dugan. I'm a member of the society, and I'm from the U.S. government, and I'm here to help you. and in Washington, maybe some of you recall the recent reports that back on the eve of the U.S. invasion of Iraq, Jose Maria Aznar of Spain was in Crawford, Texas, at the invitation of President Bush, and they were kind of sealing the deal, and. Apparently, Aznar said, okay, I'm going along. But what concerns me the most about all of this, Mr. President, is your optimism. Anyway, I'm concerned about Juan Javier's optimism about the efficacy of, you know, U.S. legal education, right, helping fix things in Latin America. And here's why. And I just invite you to consider, you know, some of the dark sides of this great country. I just invite you to consider, to encapsulate it, urge everybody, if you haven't read it, read the book by one of our greatest legal scholars, who's also one of our greatest cultural elegies. You know, it's Slouching Toward Gomorrah by Robert Bork. I really can't recommend that highly enough, because some of the things that he warned about 10 years or so ago in that book are just going on worse and worse and worse. And let me just try to boil it down to this. My wife came to this country from Mexico City about 5 years ago. She lived all of her life in Mexico City, although she was bilingual all of her life, but still, she'd never lived in this country. I'll remark to her from time to time things from Bork's book. For example, his chapter on gender feminism, that's a good one. She's just absolutely astonished, and she considers that she has moved to an uncivilized country, a country that is anti-family and that is perilously promoting, and through some of the entities that I work, exporting an anti-family culture that is corrosive of a culture of liberty. So if you care to comment.
So you're afraid that Anglo-America is turning into Latin America, and what I should be hopeful for is that Latin America become a little more like Anglo-America. Rather than looking at the question that way, I would say, yes, we admire American legal education, but we want to work with our own legal tradition. In law and economics, people say the common law is efficient. Well, in Latin America, we have Roman law. Roman law is almost a paradigmatic system of private law. And so what we're working very hard to do is, within our own legal tradition, we want to return to our Roman law roots. We want to return our legal system to a system of private law. And with economic integration in the future, we have an opportunity not to correct the legal system of each of the countries in Latin America, but to start creating, building institutions, regional legal institutions that will be an alternative. We're going to superimpose an alternative regional institutional system, and if we have good legal science like law and economics, then we forgot about law in the 1990s. We had very good economists, but economics has to partner with law and economics. We need to have a vision of the importance of private law to an economy, and we have to realize that the failure of Latin America, to a great extent, is the failure of law. For example, something so important, people always say that foreign direct investment is very important. But then Puerto Rico should be much richer than it is, considering how much foreign direct investment and aid the island receives from the United States. Don't forget that it is internal financial intermediation that happens through the legal system that is very important for local growth. It is local entrepreneurs who are able to either adapt existing knowledge or even be creative who are the people who really make an economy grow. And let us not forget that an economy can grow very quickly if the right institutional circumstances are there. So yes, we need to focus on legal education, and we need to focus on a community of local legal scholars. We need alternatives. Please don't tell me I'm an optimist, because I think that being young and Latin American right now is very depressing.
We're really almost out of time, but we have two very short questions. First from Morton Blackwell.
Morton Blackwell, the Leadership Institute. I want to direct my question to a specific aspect of the relationship between law and liberty in Latin America. In Europe, there are numbers of countries that have laws that say that if you hire someone and they stay on for a certain period of time, an employer is thereafter obliged to make an enormous payment to that employee when they are let go. The National Party in South Africa imposed such laws during apartheid, and I presume they're still in effect. Last month I encountered a Lithuanian who was saying that they have imposed such laws in Lithuania and the Baltic countries, and I think everyone here would agree that such laws are a deterrent to economic growth. My question is, are such laws in effect in Latin America?
You can answer in two sentences.
Yes. Labor laws are one of the very big problems. And we think we can correct what's wrong with our legal systems, for example, with antitrust law, which is absolutely paradoxical. Yes, what we need to do is what is really obvious. We need to return to the fundamentals of our legal system and private law, and we have to. We don't need antitrust law. We don't need labor law. We don't need constitutional law. A little more administrative law in terms of avoiding arbitrariness in government and maybe negative constitutionalism, of course.
Because we need to finish. Please, Lee Edwards.
Lee Edwards with the Heritage Foundation. One of the great success stories, as we all know, in America is the Federalist Society. And there are now, I think, over 100 chapters of the Federalist Society at college, universities, and here. So my suggestion to you, sir, is that you get in touch with Eugene Meyer, the president of the Federalist Society, that perhaps there already is a program in existence, I'm not a lawyer, I don't know, in which they're looking at Latin America. But I'm sure that Gene would be happy to put you in touch with, and you could begin maybe working out some relationship between what you hope to do and what the Federalist Society is already doing so successfully here in America.
Let's thank our speakers and... And the next session is at 10:15.